ILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
This week on Keeping the Faith, we have a very pertinent topic beyond partisanship. We're going to be talking about the Living Democracy Project of Bloomington Normal with our guest in our studio today, Charlene Watts. Welcome, Charlene.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Good to have you here. How long have you been involved in this Living Democracy Project?
The project began some 7 years ago in that very volatile election year of 2004 when the polarization of opinions in this country was at an all-time high.
And what did people in Bloomington Normal decide they could do about that? Such a huge problem. As we've just been reminded this last weekend.
Some of our thinking was guided really by the fact that about eight of us had been part of a study group reading Jim Wallace's book, God's Politics. And so we were kind of inspired and challenged by him to help reinvigorate democracy by providing opportunities for citizens' voices to be heard. The fact was that if you were going to have government by, for, and of the people had to feel like they had some power, that they could be part of determining the government of this country.
And you thought that there were some things that could be done locally that could kind of demonstrate that, explore that issue?
We felt that if we gave citizens a safe and easy, in a way, opportunity to come together and talk about something that mattered for the common good, that they would hopefully feel better about being more responsible and active citizens in the future.
Now, we should specify early on that we're talking about Bloomington Normal in Illinois. There is, of course, a Bloomington, Indiana within the sound of this broadcast. And since this is heard all around on podcasts, we're talking about Bloomington, Illinois, and it's a twin city, Bloomington and Normal. Now, are there divisions between those cities? Does one tend to be more Republican, one Democrat, or is what's that mix in your town?
Oh, we wouldn't dare admit that, Steve,
you wouldn't say
if
that.
We were. No, I think we have three universities. I mean, one community college and two universities.
Right.
So it's a real mix. It's nearly 150,000 if you count the students at the, you know, colleges also. So, no, I wouldn't say that you could categorize.
There's not that kind of a split.
No.
Okay. And when you have elections for county government, is that separated by Republican, Democrat, or are you kind of a one-party area?
No, it's separated. Although now you're going to test my knowledge of Normal is over against Bloomington. We just had an election in Bloomington, which is a ward government.
Okay.
Whereas Normal, the candidates run for the whole community.
I see. Okay. Well, Champaign-Urbana has a long history of how do we get along and what are the differences between the two cities politically. And so there's a lot of partisanship even in supposed elections that are nonpartisan. So it gets very confusing sometimes in towns like this. Well, let's talk about your Living Democracy Project that's there in Bloomington Normal. Over the 7 years, what have been the things that you've done that you've just felt best about, most successful?
Well, I think just in the first place, giving these opportunities. We started out giving opportunities for civil discourse, whether it was inspired by a panel presentation or just giving opportunities around a small table of a dozen people to discuss a particular issue. We always provided a trained facilitator, and we had ground rules for this. You may have remembered several years ago around the country, there were what were called cafe conversations.
Huh.
That was one of those things that I'm afraid stayed a fad for a while and then has kind of disappeared. But we moved on from just providing opportunities for civil discourse to realizing in study of some other books, including Democracy's Edge by Francis Morlapay, that one of the greater threats, even than lack of these opportunities for discourse, to democracy's future in this country was the power of money, and especially the power of money and its influence over who ran, who could run in an election, and over what ended up being in legislation, whether it was at the local or the federal level. So we kind of got on the bandwagon that was already going in several states for what were called clean election laws. That was, you took the overwhelming influence of money out of elections by having some public funds be used if candidates opted in. Now, it was always a choice of candidates, and several states, including Maine, Arizona, Vermont, and several cities, including Portland, Oregon, have opted for this and have found it very successful in enabling anybody to be able to run for office and for the public then to judge who was the better candidate and hopefully downplay the influence of money.
There's some, you mentioned some states in a city or two that have laws that let that happen. What's the case here in Bloomington, Normal, or Illinois?
No, it's a long way from happening here, I'm afraid. One reason is that there still exists on the books of Illinois law a law passed in 1992 that forbids the use of public funds for campaigning. Now, that law was passed long before anybody had heard of publicly funded elections, and it was really aimed at incumbents running to be reelected and being forbidden to use their expense accounts, so to speak, for that campaign. But since it's still on the books, that's one thing that will have to be repealed or changed before there's much reason that publicly funded elections could be passed here.
Hmm. We're talking with Charlene Watts from Bloomington, Normal, Illinois, about the Living Democracy Project there that's been going on since 2004. That's an attempt to get beyond partisanship and to create civil discourse in our society, more of it. This program is live, and it's a call-in show. And this is one of the programs that we encourage people to be part of. So if you'd like to go to your telephone, pull out your cell phone, wherever you're sitting listening to this, give us a call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area, 217 area code, punch in 333-9455 and talk with our guest, Charlene Watts, and me. If it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. Now, I know just before this program began, you heard an announcement that if you'd like to pledge during our spring pledge week, we are also taking pledges this hour, and you may punch in for that phone call, 244-9455. So they all end WILL, but if you want to make a pledge, 217-244, or you can go to willpledge.org and make a pledge online. But to be on the air live with us and to join in this conversation, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 222-9455, and that's a 1-800 number, 1-800-222-9455. And that's true even if you're listening on the Internet somewhere else in the country. Charlene, you mentioned Jim Wallace's book, God's Politics. The subtitle of that book is so great. It's Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. Now, when your study group looked at that book, what did it motivate you to do? What ideas did you get from there that were particularly helpful?
I think the main idea that hit us was that democracy really was under threat of almost extinction because we no longer really participated, most of us, in its perpetuation. And that the people had to, so to speak, take it back from the very moneyed powers that were now having their voice much more heard than the average citizens. And so, you know, our challenge was to find ways to do this kind of what we called reinvigorating democracy. And, you know, we have over the years changed gears several times in how we did that, and it's still a challenge for how you convince citizens that their voice does matter and that it can have an influence on what happens in our legislatures.
We have a call from Tuscola, line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Charlene. Go ahead.
Hi, Steve, Charlene.
Yes.
Alex Ruggieri calling from Tuscola. I was just curious. I think the concept is really fantastic, but I'm curious the mechanism and how it would work for folks to qualify for the funds and what limits would be put on the funds. Certainly, your guest can speak to that and give us all a sense of how the mechanics of this and how it would work when we're using public funds for access to candidates for electoral purposes.
Thank you for the question. Charlene?
Well, you could fill several volumes with the details on this, and for the amount I know, you could put in one volume. But from what we do know of Arizona and Maine, they vary terrifically in what their legislatures have determined to be the details. But there are very specific qualifiers for, you know, for how to run and how much money or how little money the candidate themselves can raise, and then how that gets matched by public funds and where the public funds come from. In Arizona, it's basically traffic ticket income that has been used for financing public funding. They now, which is interesting, which I think is a sign of the success of this approach, is that 75% of their legislature now opts to run as quote-unquote clean candidates. In Maine, it's quite different in terms of the details, but basically it's that there are very clearly laid out standards for how you go about running as a quote-unquote clean candidate. And there are parameters on how much money you can raise, what an individual's contribution, you know, the limits of that as well as how the state legislature is going to fund it. Studies have shown that the current election style that we use, which allows huge amount of wealth from a very small percentage of both corporate and individual contributions, is far more costly to the public in terms of what ends up as the cost of legislation in the end than in states where they have had clean elections. One interesting little tidbit about Maine is that Maine now has a very progressive health care, or they passed a very progressive health care bill only after they had a large majority of clean candidates in their legislature, because the influence then of either health insurance companies, the pharmaceuticals, you know who I'm talking about, that was just nearly reduced to zero because they knew they couldn't use the leverage of the dollar bill.
And so the lobbyists couldn't go in and say, look, we gave you $500,000. You owe us this bill, because if they were elected with public funds, they didn't have that hold over them, that power.
Right.
Yeah. I love the idea of using parking ticket fines to fund elections. That's marvelous. Let me give the phone numbers again. 333-9455 is the local number. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455. And thank you, Alex, for that question. Very good question. Charlene, let's learn a little bit about your background before you got involved in this Living Democracy project there in Bloomington. Tell me where you grew up.
I grew up, as you may hear in the voice, in Kentucky, and ended up going north to college, though, at the College of Worcester in Ohio. And there I met Richard, my husband of 57 years, And he was training to be a Presbyterian minister, and from there on.
You've been involved in a lot of social causes in many different places. Tell me about growing up in Kentucky. What part of Kentucky?
Lexington.
Public schools?
No, I went to a lab school, the University of Kentucky's, from nursery school all the way through high school, and determined to go away to college.
Uh-huh. And you chose the College of Worcester in Ohio. What did you study there?
Sociology.
Uh-huh. And you met Dick Watts there. What was your family name?
My family name was Whitehouse.
Whitehouse. Okay. And how have you maintained this wonderful Kentucky accent all of these decades?
Probably you would say out of laziness.
I only lived 12 years in the South in North Carolina, but when I'm talking with someone with a Southern accent, some of it comes back to me, and I'm not making fun of you. It's just natural. I grew up in Champaign-Urbana, but after seminary, I went to North Carolina and was there 12 years, then came back to my hometown. So I had a big circle. And some people in Chicago, of course, think Champaign-Urbana is in the South anyway, but not quite. How long have you lived in Bloomington Normal? You've been there sort of on and off, haven't you, a bit?
We have lived in Bloomington Normal 4 different times ever since we left Champaign-Urbana in 1962.
And what were you doing in Champaign-Urbana?
That was Dick's first job right here at McKinley Foundation with Jim Hine and Presbyterian ministry there on campus.
And what were you doing while he was doing that?
Raising our first child.
Uh-huh. How many children
You're
do you
stretching
have?
Stretching my memory here.
How many children do you have?
We now have five grown children.
5 grown children.
9 grandchildren, almost grown.
Ah. Very good. So is it fair to say that you're a senior citizen? You said you were married 57 years.
Yes, I'll freely admit I turned 77 next month.
And where do you find the energy and the passion to still be doing this kind of social action?
Well, you know, I think the change, you might say, came in my own life when I went to work for the Presbyterian Hunger Program when our last child was about 9 years old. And I discovered then that I didn't know a thing about the real world and how it operated, and was reading people who knew a lot more than I did about why there was hunger in the world. Turns out it had nothing to do with food. It had a lot to do with the basic paradigm that was driving the world's economy. And so ever since then, I have been passionate about a vision that I think grows out of my faith, really, of that we ought to organize society with the bottom line of people, not greed or money.
So you found out that world hunger was really based on politics and economics and not on the failure of agriculture or something.
Very much so. And Frances Morlapay really helped me understand that. If you remember her book, Diet for a Small Planet, she was one of these that was so intrigued with the issue of why there was so much hunger. She spent a whole year of graduate school studying it and came to the conclusion I've shared.
Now, you say from your own faith you see connections between how you choose to spend your life lobbying and educating and being socially active. How do you draw those lines? How does that connection work for you?
Well, it's why I'm also involved in fair trade, because its bottom line is the person, and the question you ask is what effect will this have on people, not what will it grow the economy. Not that that question doesn't need to be raised also, but the bottom line question would be the effect on people. And the same question is what, when you're working with democracy, that's what democracy asks, really, too. As well as I say, the biblical faith, I think that's what Micah was all about when he said, you're to seek justice.
Tell us about fair trade.
Fair trade is over against free trade in a way has, as I said, its bottom line is honoring the value of the person and that every person deserves a fair return for their labor. Right now, we live in a world's economy that sees people, though, as cogs in a machine. And the overriding question that is asked about any economics deal is, where can I have it made cheapest? And then turn around and ask, where can I sell it for the highest price? Our concern in trying to be kind of a parable of justice in that sea of injustice is to ask the question, what value do we put on the human being that produced the item, whatever it be, whether it's harvesting coffee beans, so you now have fair trade coffee, or whether it's making some beautiful item from a hunk of onyx.
And some places make a specialty of selling items that have been produced in under a fair trade system, like 10,000 Villages, for example.
Yes, and you have a shop right here in Champaign-Urbana,
yes.
And you'll have to come over and see our shop in Bloomington. But it's interesting. I've been in this for over 35 years, never earned a penny from it. We work with all volunteers. But it's amazing what has happened. I mean, when we opened a shop in Cleveland, Ohio in 1979, we were one of about three shops in the country.
In the country, yeah.
And they're now over 100. And it's a growing concern of people that we are wearing clothing, for instance, paid for by the lives of, for instance, women in Honduras who are making 15 cents an hour making that blouse.
And in contrast, if you buy a good that's been through the fair trade system, the producers, there have been people who've checked out what their wages are, that they have good working conditions, and they're given a living wage of some sort, depending
yes.
on the culture where they are. And so when you're paying to buy that product, it's in contrast to what you just said.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I recently, my wife and I went to visit our grandchildren in Philadelphia, and I wanted to take them a few little presents. And so I went to the 10,000 Villages and got something fun for my 9-year-old granddaughter. And then I asked them what was the loudest thing they had there for my 9-year-old grandson, because I want to get even with his father. So I got a great rattle. It just makes
yes.
a horrible noise. So that was fun.
Yes.
But my son took it in good humor. So.
Good.
But they do have a wide assortment of things from all over the world at stores like that that focus on fair trade. And there are many congregations that focus on helping bring fair trade items, such as coffee,
yes.
to their parishioners, to their congregants.
Would you believe there is now fair trade wine?
Really?
Because of the exploitation of some of the wineries or vineyards, I should say, around the world.
Huh.
And to see that. And, of course, fair trade chocolate is a big thing now.
A big item.
Because
yes.
when it was revealed that children as young as 5 and 6 year olds were harvesting the cocoa beans on the Ivory Coast of Africa, there was a huge outcry about this. And now there are several brands of very good chocolate that is guaranteed not to be done on the backs of these children.
Produced without exploitation. We're getting close to halfway at our program today with our guest Charlene Watts from Bloomington Normal. She's involved with the Living Democracy Project there. We'll be learning more about that in just a minute. Our discussion today is how to get beyond partisanship. And listeners are encouraged to join the conversation. Again, 333-9455 will put you in this several lines into our studio, and our engineer, Kyle Crow, will answer the phone and get you in line to talk with our guest. If it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. If you've missed part of this program or would like to hear other programs that have been archived, you may go to the website at will.illinois.edu/keepinthefaith and leave the G off of keeping. We're very informal here, and you'll get a whole list of our programs for back for several years, and you can see some things perhaps you'd like to listen to at your convenience. I had a friend tell me that they went all the way to Texas driving, listening to past Keeping the Faith programs that they'd missed, that they could get on their online and somehow on their phone, and then get into their radio system in their car, and all night long they were listening to WILL. It's amazing what can be done these days. My name is Steve Shoemaker, and this is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana, and as I said, online at will.illinois.edu. Again, this is our spring pledge week, and if you'd like to make a donation to keep this program and other programs here on WILL, like Focus 580 and Afternoon Magazine, many others, do make a pledge. We're looking for 1,000 pledges in 1 week. You may go online and make that pledge at willpledge.org, willpledge.org, or call 217-244-9455, and you can use your Visa, MasterCard, Discover, or American Express. We do depend on listeners for support for these programs. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, we're delighted to have Wayne Pittard, who is the director of the Spurlock Museum. For many years, this museum was on the fourth floor of Lincoln Hall. It's been there 100 years, but now there's a wonderful new building and many fascinating things added to the collection. Wayne Pittard was the head of the Religious Studies program here at the university and has done wonderful archaeological work. And he'll be talking about the Spurlock Museum today after 100 years of collecting and connecting. So that'll be next week here on Keeping the Faith. The following week, since we were just talking about archaeology, Wayne did his work in Israel, by the way, we'll be talking with some recent visitors to the Holy Land and talking about opportunities that people have from around the world to visit the Holy Land. So that'll be on what turns out to be Easter Sunday. That'll be April 24. Later in May, we have a couple musical guests on the program. Laura Kakoma, who sings under the name of Somi, S-O-M-I. We'll be talking with her and playing some of her African-influenced music on May 1st. On May 8th, jazz tenor saxophonist John Ellis will be our guest. His group Double Wide has some fascinating albums out. Puppet Magic, I guess, is the most recent one. So we'll be playing a few cuts from that and talking with John about the spirit of jazz, this wonderful American art form. At the University Y, who has supported this program for many years, there's a very nice art exhibit of undergraduate art in the main lounge. It's free to see anytime the Y is open. And Friday Forum and other university programs are over for this semester as students are looking forward to final exams. But the art show is there, and people are encouraged to stop by the University Y, 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign, to see an exhibit of current undergraduate student art. The Department of Religion at the University of Illinois is sponsoring the Thulin Lecture for 2011, coming up on April 14. That's this coming Thursday night at 8 o'clock at the Spurlock Museum in the Knight Auditorium, K-N-I-G-H-T. That's at 600 South Gregory Street in Urbana. The lecture is on the future of Islam and U.S.-Muslim world relations. And the speaker is from Georgetown University, the distinguished scholar John L. Esposito. That's again this Thursday night at 8 o'clock. It's a free lecture at the Spurlock Museum, sponsored by the Department of Religion at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Well, getting back to our guest for today, Charlene Watts, we're talking about the democracy, the Living Democracy Project in Bloomington, and how it's trying to find various ways to get beyond partisanship. Tell us about some of the other programs you've had, Charlene.
Okay, well, I mentioned that we had worked on publicly funded elections for considerable amount of time, and then having found that Illinois law, we kind of decided to change gear and go back to providing opportunities for civil discourse. We, in doing some research about some models to consider, we came across Kettering Foundation's National Issues Forum. And they've done for many, many years really a very excellent job of providing materials for what they call deliberative dialogue. And so we sent 10 people up for training near Chicago to be trained as facilitators for their model. The model uses the approach that they do not want it, the dialogue at the forum, to kind of devolve into a debate. And the way to make sure that this doesn't happen is to, on any issue, have three or four approaches on the issue. And for each of the approaches, which they put on what they call a placemat, you would give both the pros and the cons of that approach, the consequences of following that approach, the trade-offs that would be involved if you did take that approach to the issue in question, and then this in small table groups of perhaps 10 people with a trained facilitator and a recorder, the groups have this kind of deliberative dialogue about the issue and about each approach on it. Then they bring back through the recorder to the large group their kind of consensus on the particular issue and what they think could be ongoing action on that issue. We just 2 weeks ago had our fourth public forum. This one we used the materials from National Issues Forums called Why School? In other words, what is the mission of public education in the 21st century? And while we didn't have the turnout that we'd had on the one last year that we did on the Illinois budget deficit, which we still haven't seen really any positive results of from our deliberation, but we're hopeful. On this issue, we did have some education people such as teachers and administrators participate, which was good in that we wanted them to not feel that we were trying to compete with them, but we were trying to give citizens a voice in the public education in our community.
And be supportive. Did either of the superintendents of school manage to come to that particular forum?
We had the superintendent from one of our districts. Okay. We have two districts, yes. One for Bloomington, one for Normal.
Champaign and Urbana have that same split. Right.
Yes.
So the National Issues Forum and this training that people took, does that cost something? Did people have to come up with money to get that training and then bring it back to Bloomington Normal?
Yes, we kind of funded ourselves.
Okay.
And because we're still – the Living Democracy Project is – volunteer, even though we're now incorporated.
Okay.
So hopefully we can go for some grants to facilitate future forums. But I should have added that one of the prime considerations in their model is that the moderator in response to anything participants share is to help the participant know why they said that. In other words, to get at the values that participants have. And it turns out in the kind of experience of the National Issues Forums and Kettering Foundation that most of us human beings have only about three or four main values. And it turns out there's a lot more common values. There are a lot more common values than we often think when we get arguing an issue.
What would you say your most prominent values are, your two or three most prominent values?
The value of people.
Okay.
And a value of love, and but love based on justice.
I'm glad you added the justice, because when people talk about love, it seems sort of so mushy.
Yeah, mushy.
Yeah, sort of warm feelings, yeah, but yeah. Where does that sort of hit the road? Where
no.
does that make a difference?
You know, I love that term when I was raising children, of tough love. There's more to it than mush, as you said. But I think that's a real important part of these forums, is that it does kind of liberate people to see that their neighbor, who they thought they disagreed with, really, when pushed to see why they said what they said, they could sympathize with that in a way that they didn't when they just heard what they had to say in the first place, if that makes sense.
It does. I remember when I was trying to understand a libertarian that I had come in contact with in my college years, what was behind some of his philosophy. It seemed very strange to me. At the time, he was saying, sell the post office, and he was saying, you know, radio, offshore radio, and talk about things like that. But when we pushed to see what his values were back in those days, I found that we were really quite sympathetic with one another, and we became great friends. And we even ended up naming him as the godfather for our first child.
Oh.
He became a philosopher of science at Indiana University. Mm. And, but at first I thought, this libertarian stuff, that's really far out. But it's surprising where he was basing it on some of the similar Christian values that I was basing my more liberal or even radical leftist philosophies on.
Well, somebody said if you just take time to hear somebody's story, it makes it a lot better for understanding where they're coming from.
Well, let's give listeners another chance to tell their stories or share their values. The number's 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana listening area. If it's long distance, punch in 1-800-222-9455. And we do realize that people are listening live on various electronic means through their smartphones or computers or whatever. And so if you're in the continental U.S., you can use that toll-free number to join this live conversation. Keeping the Faith is on Illinois Public Media every Sunday night from 5 to 6 p.m. Will, 580 a.m. and heard also at 90.9 FM HD3 if you have an HD radio, which gives you some very nice reception. If you have that as that's one of the alternatives you can use, of course. Charlene, you were talking earlier about not getting into debates when you have these national issues forums. What's wrong with debate?
Well, we feel that it's kind of sets up such an adversarial environment that it's not very healthy for consensus development.
What, our Congress is not very healthy?
No. You're not going to take me there.
But that is a model that's obviously broken, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It sure is. But it just, we have really proved, I think, in some ways, on a very small scale, in the four forums that we have done, that if we do follow this way we were trained to help people get behind what they say, that it does make for a lot better atmosphere for working together on the issue.
Can you think of any breakthroughs, any positive results from this process that you've been experimenting with there in Bloomington Normal? at any of those forums? Did there seem to be any understanding that people got afterwards that they didn't have before of one another?
The interesting thing is we've done evaluations every time, and it's been amazing that we've got out of 10. We've usually had average on every single thing they were asked at over 9, which really amazed me because I'm too critical a person myself. So I probably wouldn't have given the group I was moderating that high in some of the forums, I should say. But people did express the fact that they were so happy to be listened to. And that speaks well, I think, for the model of moderation, I mean of moderating in the forums. But it also speaks for how hungry people really are to have this opportunity. But our challenge is to have more people really want to be actively involved. There is such cynicism abroad, I'm afraid, of people feeling that, well, it won't make any difference what I think anyway, and money talks, and I don't have the money.
You mentioned that your latest forum that dealt with issues in the schools was not as well attended as the one that dealt with the state budget crisis. We can understand that. But were there some positive things that came out of the forum on schools?
Yes, I think so. And there was, I should very briefly say what the three approaches were. The first approach was that education's priority, its goal should be to prepare students for jobs. The second one was to prepare them to be responsible and active citizens. And the third was much more individualistic. It was in terms of meeting the needs and helping every individual student to reach their potential. And there was somewhat of consensus added about that citizen education was a primary goal, and certainly teaching just for jobs came in a very strong third, not first or second, if you were to pick one. The main consensus seemed to be, well, you've got to do all three. The question is, what are you going to give priority to and not have get lost in an over-priority given to the economic?
We have a caller waiting to join the conversation on line one. Number line one, you're on the air with our guest, Charlene Watts. Go ahead, please.
This subject that you're exploring is very exciting, and it seems to me that we got a kind of a shocking discovery recently. We had a report on the economics of Champaign County showing that a very high percentage of our citizens have high salaries. So there's a very prosperous element to our community. But along with that, the most startling figures of poverty. So it's not just a matter of extreme poverty in Asia or somewhere else, but how does this project that you're carrying out deal with the vast difference in economic reality for people right here in our own neighborhood?
And as part of that report, I remember reading that over half of the students, for example, in Urbana High School are now receiving reduced or free lunches because they come from families where their total income is so low that we have this huge contrast between the very wealthy and the very poor.
Well, and that's a phenomenon that's not just in Champaign-Urbana, and it's true also in Bloomington-Normal, but I read an appalling statistic lately about the disparity in wealth in this country and where it's gotten at this point. In the third quarter of last year, when those banks and corps that got bailed out 2 years ago, they showed record profits in the third quarter of last year, and two-thirds of those profits went to 1% of Americans. Now, somebody wiser than I has said, you cannot have democracy and have that disparity, or some people would call it an inequality of income. and have a democracy. And so, you know, hopefully we can do something to address that. And one of our potential forums in the future is to deal with what I think most people in, for instance, Bloomington Normal are ignorant of, is the amount of poverty, the amount of dropouts in our high school, and so forth, and to, you know, get the issue on the table and say, what can we even locally do about it?
I want to thank the caller for that good point, raising that issue. That was very important. Charlene, you were saying that you come from a Christian background, in fact, a Protestant Christian background, but is this effort, this Living Democracy Project, is it interfaith in any way?
Yes, it's interfaith in the people that have participated in the forums. Yes, I'd have to think a while before I know whether our basic committee, but you know, there is a real commitment, though, of those active in leadership in the project for social justice.
We have another caller waiting. Again, on line number one, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Charlene Watts.
Yes. I have a perhaps slightly more depressing statistic for you. The 400 wealthiest individuals in this country earned more than the 150 million least wealthy.
Yeah. I don't doubt it. And, you know, the most other discouraging thing is the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. I just am floored that anybody can think more money, you know, does not give people more voice. And that's virtually what the Supreme Court said.
We saw the result of that in Wisconsin a week ago.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for sharing that information. The wealthiest 400 in America make more than the poorest 150 million.
Yeah. Well, money creates money the way that we've orchestrated our economy. You know, you can make more sitting at home on the stock market some days, I should say. And then what, you know, the maids are making cleaning our motel rooms and using their physical labor is what I should say.
And it's so hard to know how best to respond. I mean, we can do things personally. We can try to think, who's the poorest person I'm going to meet every day, and can I give them a tip? Can I give them something free that might help them a little bit? But, of course, to attack the structures and to look at society as a whole and try to say, what changes do there need to be to give more people an opportunity for a just and fair living wage? It's so difficult to get those things to happen.
And as long as we just keep thinking in terms of economics and, you know, going for growth, not really defining what needs to grow and what doesn't need to grow, I don't know. I think, as dear friend of mine 40 years ago said, it demands a paradigm change. And I think right now we are in a paradigm war, what you could say, determining whether the bottom line is going to be the common good or it's going to be the market.
When you talk about contrasting fair trade with our current capitalist system of free trade, what's wrong with free trade where it says we all have the same opportunity to be an entrepreneur, to borrow money, to start a business, to work hard, to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps? So what's wrong with that? It sounds so good.
I would question whether everybody does have that opportunity.
Because of discrimination, because of...
Sure. Where the luck of where you were born and who your mother and father were.
Your gender.
Mm-hmm.
Women still make, what, 77 cents for every dollar a man makes,
right,
for the same job.
If I were born in Bangladesh, I'd probably be dirt poor.
Uh-huh.
And But again, it's the bottom line. It's the question. I want to be like George Herbert Bush, who said, it's the economy, stupid. I want to say it's the question that we ask ourselves about any, whether it's legislation or policy decisions that we make.
Is it fair? Is it just?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. 'Cause you and I, in this culture right now, as somebody wiser than I again has said, we are treated, well, it was Bill Moyers that said this, treated as consumers, not human beings.
Uh-huh.
We're judged, our value is judged by what we can consume or produce, not by the fact that we're breathing.
Uh-huh. Now, we've talked about some pretty discouraging statistics.
That's right.
We've been pretty negative, but some of us this weekend, as Jews are approaching Passover, as Christians are approaching Easter, are thinking of somehow hope and, yes, remembering the past, but looking forward to new possibilities, new life. Where do you get hope to keep going?
I would say in the vision that I feel is given. It's not just given through your faith, though, in a way. The prophets and Jesus, or whether it was Buddha or Muhammad or whom, who really all said the same thing about the value of people. But it's also in my experience of life, that the meaning of life is found in relationships. And I keep hope. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I get discouraged too. But you keep hope because you know you got to keep the vision, and there's no point in wasting your energy on cynicism.
Where did your vision, your values first come from as you were growing up?
From my home.
Your family?
And the church.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
What were your parents like?
They were good, honest people who were very good at giving us, my brother and me, opportunities to grow into independence.
And they clearly cared about education. They found you places to get a good education.
Yes. And
what did you get from your church?
Church growing up, it was a much more conservative church at that point. But it was that the bottom line is people, as I put it. Maybe that sounds simplistic, but I think it's also makes a lot of difference in how I use what few talents I have or your time and whatever. But it ain't easy these days, though. Let's not fool ourselves.
Did your college years add to those values, or was there a time you really kind of questioned what you grew up hearing from your family and your church?
Oh, I'm sure I questioned a lot of and grew into much more a faith based on compassion than a faith based on belief of having to believe certain things and so forth. It was more with how you live your days.
And as you got a college education and beyond, did you wonder whether some of those simple beliefs that maybe your parents had or you heard in your youth made the whole thing a shambles, or did you pick
and choose? I never went through that
you did.
Great
uh-huh.
Change. No,
okay.
It kind of was an evolution of vision, creation, and so forth.
But coming from a conservative church in Kentucky, what did you do when you encountered the scientific theory of evolution? Did that cause you any questions?
I was lucky that my parents believed in evolution.
Ah, all right.
And I never heard it even discussed in our particular church.
Interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
You just accepted.
Yeah.
As not in conflict with your Christian beliefs.
Right. Huh.
Did you take courses in college in religion?
We had to at our college.
I see. It was a church-related
school. Required 101.
All right. And when you learned about current theories of interpreting the Bible and Did that shake your faith or did it strengthen it?
No, that was all it did was provoke curiosity. And no, it was kind of exciting, in fact, especially when Dick and I both went to seminary.
Where did you go to seminary?
McCormick in Chicago.
And what were you studying there?
Christian education.
But, what did that enable you to do?
Oh, my goodness. You're expecting me to remember back that far. I don't know. I think I had the privilege of studying under Huldah Niebuhr, who is the little-known sister of the famous Reinhold and Richard Niebuhr. And she was a John Deweyite from the get-go. And so you never knew what your homework was even. You were to figure it out. And she really made you think. But it was a wonderful experience to study under her and to realize that education could be something much more than rote learning, even in the faith.
And did you put that to use when you were in various churches, the training you got in Christian education?
Somewhat, but since I was also in the midst of raising children as well and being hopefully a good minister's wife, I didn't professionally use.
But it sounds like you're using it now with the Living Democracy Project and the National Issues Forums that you're doing.
Yes. Yeah. And, over the years I've been involved in several things that came out of working for the Hunger Program for the Presbyterian Church. I was helped create the Lakewood Christian Service Center back in Cleveland, Ohio, which had a lot to do with hopefully doing something that was socially just for those who were less fortunate and so forth. So
those were some very practical results that came from that.
Yes, yes. So it's, it's a growing experience, and I, hopefully I will, what's the phrase of that, I will not die before I, or... All right, I will not die an unlived life. That's it. Prompting from my husband.
we all need that, don't we?
Prompting from
our helpful spouses.
Well, I'll throw in that I was greatly inspired by Maggie Kuhn, who started the Gray Panthers.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And she was not going to shuffleboard her life away.
That's a wonderful place to end. We've been talking today on Keeping the Faith. Was 77-year-old. She told us very bravely. Charlene Watts from Bloomington Normal, who's been involved with the Living Democracy Project there. Next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with Professor Wayne Pittard from the University of Illinois Spurlock Museum of World Cultures. That's coming up next week. And on Easter Sunday, we'll be talking with recent visitors to the Holy Land. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
You listen to WILL every day because you find something here that appeals to you. Whether you tune in for Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Focus, or the Daily Agricultural Markets, WILL brings you the programs you enjoy throughout your day. It's radio that appeals to your love of learning, your desire for information. This is our Spring Pledge Week at WILL. Your contribution helps support these programs. Please take a moment now and make a contribution online at willpledge.org.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication.
The 2011 Vintage Vinyl Sale is Saturday, April 30th, at the former Altman's Billiard and Barstool Supply, located at 301 West Market View Drive, Champaign. And starting April 4th, We'll accept used records, CDs, DVDs, and working stereo equipment at the sale site. Call me, Dean Geiken, at 217-333-6503 for more information.